enjoy this time here in Toronto, and hopefully you won't be wasting your time. Such a beautiful day, middle of the summer. It's cool, unusual punishment to listen to physicists talk about oncology. In fact, there's a joke, I guess, an old joke about biophysicists. Who is a biophysicist? Well, that's the person who talks about biology to physicists and about physics to biologists. I'll be talking about oncology to mathematicians. That's even crazier. But yeah, 7 days ago I moved from physics to the Department of Oncology and the Cross Cancer Institute to take up this position, and I'm very grateful to the Allied Foundation for making it possible. I also feel a certain amount of responsibility on my shoulders because they are paying serious money for something that is completely untested and unproven. Anyhow, this is the title. I'll try to convince you that there is a role to be played by mathematicians, computer scientists, and physicists in the fight against cancer. And I'll give you one glimpse in this direction, in this endeavor. We're working on several other things, but there's no time in 1 hour to talk about everything. So I want to talk about one aspect. Before I do that, however, I want to acknowledge the help of my students and staff, who are very good and helpful, and I'm very proud of them. They're listed here, but I have no time to rattle off all the names. You can read that. And I think you can go to my website. There's more information always. And also, there's a lot of collaborators, both in North America and in Europe. And at the bottom, there's a two-liner about support, which is always very, very important. And most of it actually is due to the support of MITAC that was mentioned. MITAC is Mathematics and Information Technology of Complex Systems, a network of centers of excellence supported by the government of Canada. And they actually forced me to embark on this route once I accepted the project funding. We have to find matching funds from the industry. And it was very difficult at first. Now it's getting easier and easier. In the process, you switch hats, and from a physicist, you become an oncologist. But that's great. In particular, the Allard Foundation and also some private companies in the U.S. that are supporting the developmental part of this project. It's not just theoretical at this stage, as you will see. We are also doing experiments. Let me start from the beginning. Maybe I can ask you first, how many of you are mathematicians or theoretical scientists in general? And how many are clinical people? So I'll start from a very accessible level, shall we say, because probably not too many people are very familiar with drug design in general. So the concept of a drug that has activity against a particular target is that it fits, it binds, and interferes with the workings of a protein, an enzyme, or binds to a receptor site. So it either stimulates or inhibits the activity of the target. So you have to know what your target is, usually. You would like to know what the target is. And I'll tell you in a moment what our targets are in this particular case. They're very well defined. In fact, they're so well defined that it almost is almost bewildering, because we define our targets within the almost conceptual resolution to within angstroms, so microscopic. And although our calculations are largely classical, we are slowly thinking about going quantum in these calculations because of this resolution. So you're principally looking at identifying where the drug should go and how it should fit. And most of it is actually just a steric fit, geometrical fitting of two molecules in terms of the shape of the binding pocket and of the drug molecule. However, there are not too many examples of drugs that were actually designed from scratch, just by staring at something and putting atoms together into a molecule. Most of the drugs, even some very well-known drugs, as you will see, are natural compounds that were found by serendipity, by accident sometimes, and sometimes by mistake. So it's a difficult and expensive process to find drugs. Typically, to find a new drug that will be successful on the market takes between 10 and 12 years of drug development, design and development, and costs between $500 million to $1 billion, and you start with 10,000 putative molecules and end up with one or two that eventually make it to the market. And this one molecule will make the drug company about $2-3 billion a year, eventually paying off for the cost of development, and many times over. And there's the window, as you know, 17 years for patentability. Okay, now, we as scientists would like to make this process a bit more rational and maybe faster, cheaper. Doing computations could be one way of saving money. Even if we save 1% of the cost of drug development or shorten it by 1%, it may translate to something like $5-10 million. Not bad. So how can computers help design better cancer drugs? There's a whole list of things. Some of them are trivial or even maybe underappreciated, but in the end it works. So visualization, just looking at things in three plus one dimension, that is three spatial and one time dimension. Proteins and molecules are never rigid. They have their internal motions on various time scales. The time scales vary from picoseconds due to thermal agitation to seconds due to conformational changes and chemical reactions. Manipulation of these systems in silico includes diffusion calculation. So not only the drug has to fit, but it has to get there. And getting there means overcoming many obstacles on the way, membrane diffusion in particular. We also work in pharmacokinetics, the diffusion, the drug administration, distribution, elimination in the body. That's a separate topic I won't be talking about, but that's part of our project as well. And finally, once the drug is within the cell and close to the target, you want to know how well it fits, how strongly it fits in terms of the energy of binding, how stable it is, and what will happen to the structure. That process is called docking. You dock it just like docking a ship in a port, in harbor. You dock the drug molecule to the target site. All of this involves highly demanding computation. And not all of it is just computation. And it's not automated computation. A lot of it requires human intervention, manipulation, as well as code development, and in fact, open scientific problems, because, you know, physics, the area from which I started, has one unsolved problem, in particular condensed matter physics, many-body physics. The many-body problem has not been solved. In life sciences, in cell biology, everything is a many-body problem. So we don't have exact solutions. We have approximate solutions. Okay. A lot of it is statistical mechanics. You repeat these calculations over and over and over again. So parallel computing is important because you throw the same problem on several processors, a number, 100, 200 processors, and end up with a statistics, which will give you, let's say, the preference for that drug over that one on a statistical basis. Again, because it's a many-body problem, we don't have solutions that are absolutely valid. They may be statistically valid. Okay, and some of it has to do with bioinformatics searching. I won't talk too much about it. There exist algorithms that people in the field are using called quantitative structure activity relationships. Algorithms that would score the goodness of fit between target and the molecule of the drug. And much of it has to do with the surface fit, the steric fit, some of it hydrophobicity, hydrophilicity, electrostatic interactions. You can count these things. There are various algorithms. None of these are perfect, but you can buy them off the shelf. So we'll... In this talk, we will focus actually mainly on spatial fitting and some aspects of physical interactions. So the first thing is to visually inspect, if you can, the binding site, and then try to modify the drug to provide better binding to the target. This is our target. Why is a microtubule? What is a microtubule? Well, you see a cylindrical structure. This is a protein agglomeration. The protein that is the building block for microtubules is called tubulin. This protein assembles, self-assembles in the cell to form cylindrical structures with a hollow interior, typically 25 nanometers across, on the order of 10 to 20 microns long. You can grow them longer in vitro, but in the cell, they grow as long as they can, and typically when needed. And most of the time, microtubules in dividing cells are needed for mitosis. When the cell divides, it requires mitotic spindles. Mitotic spindles are these structures, the threads, that connect the centrosomes to the chromosomes via kinetochores. And by depolymerization, microtubules exert a force, a sizable force of about 750 piconewtons, to segregate chromosomes. In a nutshell, there is no cell division without microtubules. No cell, other than bacterial cells, because they do it differently, but no eukaryotic cell will ever divide without microtubules. And further, if you can intervene in this process, you will stop, arrest, or eliminate division. Eventual cells go into the programmed cell death, apoptosis, when they cannot execute some of their procedures. Okay. So the assembly, in other words, polymerization of these proteins into microtubules is critical for cell function, in particular cell division. Disruption of this process by drugs and other means is saving lives today. Microtubules, as I will show you later on from a recent paper in Nature, are the best target for chemotherapy on the market. There is nothing better than targeting microtubules in terms of chemotherapy procedures. There is a slew of molecules, several families that interact with tubulin, and the best known, and I'll show you these molecules up close and personal in a few minutes, are colchicine and Taxol. Both of these drugs are natural products, natural poisons, I should say. These are poisons. But chemotherapy is what it is. It's toxic stuff. That shows you why we are interested in microtubules. I told you they the green lines are microtubules in the cell. That's a dividing cell in the interphase between divisions. That's in a dividing cell. The pluses mean the plus end of a microtubule, the growing tip. The minuses are the stable end. This is the centrosome. Centrosome has to divide first, and then microtubular bundles in the form of asters grow out of the centrosome. And what's not shown here is the chromosomes line up in the midplate, and they will be segregated by a very intricate mechanism. It's almost like a very subtle dance. In addition, microtubules exist in neurons, in axons and soma of neurons. These are non-dividing cells. So they play other functions, and I won't be talking about it, but that's also one of our interests. This shows you, on the left you have fluorescent images of a dividing cell, and the green structures are microtubules. These are images from real experiments on living cells that divide, and the blue structures in the middle are chromosomes, the genetic material. So you can see the connection. And there's also an aspect of very interesting aspect of biomechanics, because microtubules are the most rigid structures in the cell. These are the scaffolds that the living cells use for both structural rigidity, stability, and transport. There's a lot of things going on microtubules, not just the mechanical process of connection, deconnection. And on the right, there's a cartoon of what they do in terms of segregating the chromosomes. So I hope you see the importance of this on a cell biology level. For a few years, we were actually playing with a lot of mathematical tools to understand the process. There's a lot of data coming from cell biology labs on microtubules in vitro and in vivo. They can be imaged, visualized, and analyzed under various conditions of different pH, concentrations of ions, salts, the whole thing. The important thing that I want to compress all of this into is that microtubules are special polymers. They assemble, you know, typical polymerization process is a linear kinetics process in terms of differential equations. You have a polymer and it grows because an element comes and binds to it, and then another element comes and it just grows and grows and grows. Microtubules actually don't do that. They grow, and they sometimes, for no apparent reason, stochastically shrink. So this is an interesting process to model mathematically because it's quite sophisticated. And what's indicated here is that there's a difference between the process of growth and shrinking. Depolymerization, polymerization are not mirror images of each other because there is an aspect of energetics involved in the GTP hydrolysis. GTP and ATP are the molecules that provide energy to all living processes. It's a quantum of energy. You can think about it as a quantum of energy. Energy in biology comes in units. These are the currency of energy. A growing microtubule accepts dimers that have an energy unit attached to it, to them. And when microtubules depolymerize, they lose chunks of these dimers without this unit of energy. In other words, they dissipate energy. It's a non-equilibrium process. It's a process that requires an input of energy. Just like building structures, you need to put material and energy to build a structure, a house or a road. The same here. Things do happen spontaneously, but they need to have an energy input. All right. So this is a kind of a cartoon version of a simulation showing you what happens in actuality with microtubules when they assemble. They constantly do this song and dance of growing and shrinking, and this is time series of an individual microtubule growing, shrinking, regrowing, occasionally shrinking a bit, and then collapsing completely. This is called catastrophes, and the process of regrowth is called rescues. Catastrophes, these are technical terms, catastrophes and rescues. And you can see that there is part of it is polymerization, part of it is individual depolymerization. There are also pauses, and then catastrophes. So that's altogether four processes, each of which you can think of as a stochastic process. You have four coin tosses. You toss your coin, you want to grow, you want to shrink, you want to pause, you want to shrink by a little, a lot. So we've played this game mathematically. It's kind of interesting, but in the end, you can pretty much simulate all that you can get from the experiment, but you still don't gain too much knowledge about what's happening. I've given you three examples of mathematical equations that describe this process. The first one is a recursive map. I was kind of interested to see if there was any component of chaos to it, and so I came up with a map that is, I thought it would be logistic nonlinear map. It's actually linear, but it has three random variables, R1, R2, R3. Four choices, so you need three coins to toss. 0, 1. And this is actually what you saw. It's a mathematical code that simulates this map and that shows you this simulation on the previous slide. You can rewrite it more sophisticated in terms of master equations. It's P is the probability and then of a state. The state of a microtubule is how many units it has at time T. So N is the number of units, T is time. So this defines the state of microtubule, and that's the evolution equation for the probability distribution of different states. If you have many microtubules, they will be statistically represented by long ones, short ones, and the middle ones. And you basically build a histogram of this. That's what biologists do. And these histograms can be monitored over time. So this is the way you model it. And so master equations are a natural way of simulating it, rates in, rates out, into a given state. And you have only four possibilities. That is, you can grow, you can shrink, you can pause, and you can collapse. So all of this goes into the probabilities, and the growth depends on the concentration and solution. I don't want to spend too much time on this, just to highlight that there is quite a bit of reasonable math behind it that has been developed. In the continuum limit, you actually develop this master equation to become an integral differential equation of this kind. It's a kind of like a diffusion equation of drift, and then there is an integral with a kernel. The kernel tells you what the probability is of rescuing at a given stage of the microtubule growth. So it was fun to develop these things, and I was quite happy that we could more or less simulate all the experimental data. Typically, the experiments run on the order of hours, 10 hours. Eventually, the protein deteriorates because of the constant recycling of the protein in building, and it has to actually rebind GTP to be assembly competent. But the typical time span is on the order of 8-10 hours. You run experiments for that long. Yeah? Yeah. Now, let's switch gears a little bit. This was the introduction to microtubules, and now let's see what this may mean for oncology. Microtubules and cancer. So cancer is related to a failure of multiple cellular checkpoints and results in, as you know, in uncontrolled division. Cells do not synchronize their division. They do it rapidly forever, basically. They forever want to divide. And we are interested in finding what can possibly stop this process. And most of the attempts at curing cancer have to do with killing cells, those that are unruly. The problem with this is that it's not so easy to target cancer cells alone. So you end up with a lot of side effects. I mean, surgery is one aspect, but you have to remove the tumor and cells around it as well. Metastasis complicates things because you don't know exactly where the tumor is localized. It can spread, hopeless. And then you have chemotherapy. Radiation therapy is killing cells with radiation, high-energy radiation. You wreak havoc. This is really an overkill. And then you have chemotherapy. Chemotherapy delivers poisons. But typically it's done by in infusion over some period of hours, actually, on a weekly basis or so. The patient's given a cocktail of toxins that spread throughout the body. Our ultimate objective is to find molecules that will only go where they are needed, to kill cancer cells, but they are not binding and doing damage to healthy cells. I'll skip this. This is just a little bit of physical information about microtubules and tubulin. Once again, tubulin is the protein that makes up microtubules. The garden variety comes in two forms, alpha and beta tubulin. There's many more, as you'll see. As with every other protein, it is expressed somewhat uniquely by every cell in the body, and in different species, it looks different a little bit. There's the whole aspect of evolution. Tubulin has been around on this planet for 2 billion years. All the eukaryotic cells express tubulin. In other words, tubulin is almost as old as life on Earth. So it's kind of an interesting project which we are doing on the side to find out what evolutionary changes occurred to tubulin from paramecium, a single-cell organism, to the human brain. A major breakthrough occurred in 1997, and I was privileged to witness it, the breakthrough when Ken Downing from Berkeley presented his results of electron crystallography on tubulin. So it took about 30 years for crystallographers to eventually come up with the structure of tubulin. And that was presented at Banff at our conference in 1997, published in Nature, and now you can find several entries for tubulin in the protein data bank. Some of them are listed here, now there's more. The original one was one tab. These are the so-called ribbon diagrams of the tubulin dimer from two different angles. It gives you the dimensions of the building block of microtubules. I want to emphasize and point out to you several important structural elements. So you have the alpha helices and beta sheets and turquoise. And the elements of great importance to it are GTP molecules right here and here. This is beta tubulin, this is alpha tubulin. In alpha tubulin, the GTP molecule, the energy-giving molecule, stays GTP, does not hydrolyze and does not impart energy to the structure. In beta, it changes from GTP to GDP, losing one phosphate and giving off some energy. This purple structure looking like grapes is Taxol, the most successful chemotherapy compound on the market. It was used to stabilize microtubules for the experiment. And as a byproduct, we know where it binds. Okay, so with this structure, this is our blueprint. We got a blueprint for calculations. The calculations we do are called molecular dynamics, and they use commercial available programs that simply put our energy minimization programs. They find the minimum energy for a structure, and they use classical Newtonian equations of motion for all the atoms of the protein, and these are the interactions that are included. The interactions have to do with the vibrations in the bonds, torsional angles, dihedral angles, and also interactions due to electrostatics, Coulomb interactions, polar interactions, van der Waals, and also hydrogen bonds are included. Different programs on the market differ in the parameterization that is given to particular groups and their energies. There is no single program that does it ideally, but you know, therefore we use several just for comparison's sake, and one package we purchased and played with is called Insight2. We also use Charm and Gromax. For those who know, it means something. For those who don't, it doesn't mean anything anyway, but you have to invest some money and time in hardware and software and training people. Once again, I'll show you now three different views of tubulin. This is important because we're kind of moving in the direction now in my talk where I'll see what new information we're going to gain by looking at this. So once again, we're looking at a tubulin dimer. We've added here these structures. These are so-called C-termini, polypeptide chains composed of about this one 12 and this one 16 residues, amino acids. The entire structure has about 1,000 amino acids. And translate into atoms. How many atoms are we talking about? About 10,000 atoms. 10,000 atoms. And you have to solve 10,000 coupled Newton's equations. Okay, that explains to you why we do it on the computer. I cannot solve it by hand or in my head. Okay, so you have the GTP molecules. This is a very interesting structure that occurred as a result of our simulations. So I told you that microtubules are unstable. They collapse occasionally by themselves. In the cell, actually, there are associated proteins that prevent this collapse. So the cell is doing all kinds of stuff with it that normally in the lab you wouldn't. But without these associated proteins, microtubules grow and shrink. How do they shrink? Well, we discovered by simulation that this is the key structural element that acts like a switch. So when it's called the M-loop. This M-loop, when it's in the, let's call it the down position or the right position, it stabilizes a straight conformation of the dimer, and the entire structure, cylindrical structure, is stable. If the M loop switches to the left position or off position, it's like a light switch, then the result of it is a conformational change that bends it. And when you bend enough of these dimers in a tip, you basically burst the cylinder open. So it's a mechanical, chemical interaction, or chemomechanical. The first thing is actually a chemical transformation. So GTP hydrolysis causes the switch to change. That in turn leads to a major conformational change in the dimer. That in turn collapses the structure. It's a bit like building a house of cards. Okay, and suddenly you shift one of the cards, and the whole house of cards collapses. I will not spend too much time on the rest of it. Some of it is important for monomer and dimer-dimer interactions. I will draw your attention to the yellow structure, which is this Taxol molecule, the chemotherapy drug. And you see what it does. Okay, now is the explanation of the activity of Taxol. Taxol keeps the loop down in the on position. As a result of it, this loop, as you can see, is physically closed, and it's prevented from spontaneously switching. And what happens then is that the microtubule stays straight and stable, doesn't collapse. Why is that good for keeping the cell from dividing? Because suppose you have you're looking at a cancer cell. It has grown the mitotic spindles. It has grabbed the chromosomes. It's about to divide. And now you give it Taxol. The Taxol will freeze this in time. These mitotic spindles will not be able to shrink anymore, and the cell will not divide. This is how this particular drug works. Okay. We started poking around the structures, looking for interesting things on it. One interesting thing to physicists is charge distribution. The blue is the negative charge. And as it turns out, there's 50 negative charges on the surface of one protein. It's hugely negatively charged. It right away explained a lot of things to us, one of which was that microtubules don't like other microtubules. They don't actually touch physically because of the electrostatic repulsion. There are some other things, but in the interest of time, I'll skip it. We calculated the potential around it, electrostatic potential. We calculated the interactions between neighboring charges, dipoles. Long story. Again, I'll keep it short. This is kind of interesting. I hope some of you took electricity and magnetism. Now we have to look with open eyes on this. So we have a protein which is very negatively charged. If proteins existed in vacuum, they would never build a cell because most of the proteins are negatively charged. They would repel each other like hell. But what happens here, they actually build structures. They come together, they build a microtubule. Other proteins build actin filaments, other filaments. Okay, they function. What happens is proteins in the cell are in water, right? And in water there are ions, counter ions. The whole thing is electrostatically neutral. So there are positive ions in the cell, sodium, potassium in principle, and calcium. And these ions surround the protein and by and large neutralize the negative charge. So you have a sphere of attraction, if you will. On the left, you see the tubulin dimer in vacuum. See, it has a roughly spherical electrostatic potential around it. It's a negative potential because the charge, it attracts positive ions. Here is the result of our simulations in a big box surrounding a dimer. So we did a simulation with 100,000 atoms. Now, from 10,000, you go to 100,000 atoms. 100,000 differential equations coupled together. That includes the atoms of water and ions. And what's shown here is the potential in solution. You see, this is now dipole, mainly, roughly a dipole potential, so negative, positive, with some bubbles. So, but you go from monopole to dipole. And that explains to you why electrostatics has to be very careful to take into account. In vacuum, it would be largely monopole-monopole interactions. In solution, it's dipole-dipole interactions that dominate the scene. Okay, I'll skip this one. So you had we were very ambitious. We tried to do this is our dream in the computer to assemble the whole microtubule by bringing together thousands of dimers and forming the cylinder. Now it turns out that you need 180 million CPU hours to do that, as we recently did the back of the envelope calculation. So we gave up on this, but nonetheless, there are some interesting things that you can do with individual dimers. Okay, that's the illustration of this potential and the counter ions around it. You can do something called Brownian dynamics, which is Brownian motion of a dimer with a realistic electrostatic potential and counter ions moving around stochastically. And you can try and assemble bits and pieces by measuring the association disassociation rates of these things. So that's a project that is interesting scientifically, but maybe not so practically important. And then you can start looking at these, I don't know if you see, there will be a slight conformational change that is known to occur when you bring dimers together, a slight distortion, because in the end you form a cylinder with a kind of helical wraparound symmetry, as you will see. Okay. This is an experimental result here to show you a single protofilament of tubulin. This is our reconstruction. So now you have a single line of dimers, protofilament. You need 13 of them to make a cylinder and close it up. So you do it by adding protofilaments. And actually, a very interesting paper came up last year in Protein Science, and my former student published it, David Sepp. He calculated the energy between these protofilaments when you slide one against the other. This is the result. David Sepp, Protein Science, 2004. And he found, doing the calculation of the sliding of these two filaments against each other, that there are two energy minima. And they actually, when you look at what this would mean in terms of the structure, they correspond to two known experimentally determined crystallographic structures of microtubules, the so-called A lattice and B lattice. These are the ones. A lattice is more common, I think 83% of the cases of microtubules. Sorry, this is more common, B lattice. This is A lattice. That's a perfect crystallographically periodic structure. This is not perfect, B lattice. As you can see, there is a discontinuity. So, in spite of the fact that we cannot calculate the properties of an entire microtubule with millions of atoms, we can predict some of the properties. I'll show it to you in a... This is two slides down, I think. You'll see the chart distribution in a second. This is interesting. That's also our modeling result, reconstruction of what the surface looks like. I showed you an idealized surface of a microtubule in this slide. The reality is much more complex. In reality, these protofilaments have big holes between them. You see these holes? These holes are roughly 1.5 nanometers long and maybe 0.5 nanometer wide. And they are very, very important. It turns out, if this is your microtubule, and I showed you Taxol, the best drug on the market, you know what happens? It does not. It binds inside the microtubule. This was a big surprise that came out of Berkeley experiments. Taxol binds inside, and the bigger surprise yet is it doesn't diffuse through the open ends. It diffuses through the surface. Diffuses through these holes. Now, so we are trying to think about it as a potential use for drug design. You can design drugs that will not go through some holes. These holes are specific to specific tubulin varieties. So some cells will have a slightly different opening here. So that's one idea for development. To answer your question, this is the charge distribution on the surface of microtubule. Again, they said my former student published in PNAS 2001, I think. Yeah, one. Red means negative charge in this case. Blue is positive. And two different ends of the microtubule have different charge distributions. So that's kind of interesting in its own right. Okay, now how much time do I have? I'm coming to the sort of the grand finale of the talk, if you will. So I hope by now you're kind of familiar with what microtubules are, how they behave, where you can find them, and what they do. A good friend of mine, Richard Ludueña, is a world expert on so-called tubulin isotypes. The human body expresses at least 20 different tubulin forms called isotypes. If it's in one organism, it's called isotypes. If it's different organisms, it's called isoforms. These are the 8 crucial beta tubulin isotypes. Why beta? Because beta is the monomer that makes all these changes. It binds to Taxol also, so it's the one that it should be your target to begin with. There's 8 varieties of this. And they are distributed differently in different organs. In particular, beta 3 is found in neurons, Sertoli cells, colon, 4A neurons, beta 7 in brain. What's also very important is, if you read the medical literature, beta 3 is preferentially expressed by cancers. This form of tubulin is preferred by cancers. And even more ominous is the fact that something like, I don't remember, 50% cancer patients who are subjected to paclitaxel therapy, breast cancer, ovarian cancer patients, are given this drug, and it's successful maybe in 50% of the cases on disorder, maybe 60, I don't know. But out of the remaining patients develop something called drug resistance. That is, the drug is not tolerated by the body, doesn't do any harm to the cancer, to the tumor. It does a lot of harm to the rest. So it's almost a waste of time to treat these people because they will not be successfully treated. And what's interesting is that these patients with drug resistance have beta 3 overexpression. This is a preferential type of tubulin that cancer cells assemble to fight chemotherapy. So it's very nasty. And therefore, if we could design a drug that would be specifically suited for binding to this subclass of tubulin, we would be making progress. This is showing you sequence identity. In other words, beta 3, in 90% of the residues, of which you have 450 some, 90% of those residues are the same. But 10% are different. So the 10% defines the window of opportunity. And out of the 10%, there's only several that are located where the drug binds. This is our search. This is our strategy. They differ in dynamics. Okay, so what we did under the MITAX project, we actually used something called homology modeling. You have a template. In other words, you're a tailor, right? And you have a template for what a men's suit looks like. But then people differ, right? So you have to measure the height, the arm's length, and so on. So each suit will be slightly adjusted. That's what we do. We have a template for tubulin, and this template is used for all the other isoforms, and then you let the program run and minimize the energy to find the actual shape, conformation of this. So we did this. We did this for 500 known tubulin isoforms, human, non-human, the whole slew. And we found systematic groupings, differences, and similarities. This is just one of the results, volume area comparison. The green ones are beta. All the beta tubulins follow this trend. All the alpha tubulins follow this trend. Gamma, delta, epsilon, a different trend. Okay, so this is something we can do. And we did more. Before I show you what we did, let me just quote from this paper by Mary Ann Jordan and Leslie Wilson, published 2004 in Nature Reviews Cancer, and I draw your attention to the last sentence in this paper. Conceivably, if one knew the tubulin isotype and microtubule regulatory protein composition of a specific tumor cell, one could design or choose drugs to selectively target that tumor. In other words, the structure of the target changes from patient to patient, from cell to cell. If we knew the structure of the target, we could deliver selectively. And that's the whole issue of side effects, right, of chemotherapy. If we could do that, there would be no side effects because the drug would go to the target. And that's what they are talking about, and that's what we are doing now computationally. Okay. I think in the next 5 minutes I'll wrap it up, but I just want to show you some results. And so far it was a very long introduction to how you do it and why you do it. This is another look at beta alpha tubulin dimer and another one. Three molecules are shown. Actually, there's four, but two are the same. This here is Taxol, I told you about. This here is colchicine. And this here, or here, is Vinca alkaloid. There are three well-known families of drugs that interact with microtubules: colchicine, Taxol, Vinca. Colchicine is too toxic. It's not used for drugs, for cancer. It's used for gout in small doses. Colchicine has been known for 2,000 years. It's an extract from coccus. Galen prescribed it, actually. Taxol is an extract from the yew tree. It was discovered as a cancer-fighting drug in 1972 and approved in 1992 for breast, 1994 for ovarian cancer. Vinca is an extract from periwinkle. So all three are natural extracts. This is where they bind. Where Vinca binds, exactly, all of this is within, as I told you, angstrom resolution, several, two or three angstroms. Vinca, colchicine, Taxol. We know for the first time in the history of the human race where they bind, and we can do something about it. Now we can start to design modification of these drugs that would be better suited for one type of tubulin versus another. This picture shows you exactly. Now we are zooming in. We are zooming in, showing you individual atoms of the drug, individual surfaces of the target on tubulin. These are two variants of Taxol. Paclitaxel is the one that is marketed by Bristol Myers Squibb that makes $2 billion a year. Docetaxel, colchicine, different. Crocus? Okay, so chemists have these structure activity relations that they tell you where you can make a modification, where you cannot. This is experimental science. Okay, we're coming very close to the point of the whole talk. So we've looked at beta tubulin sequences. These are sequences of amino acids with the letters designing the 20 different amino acids. The purple lines show you where the differences occur between beta 1, beta 2, beta 3, beta 6. We've done it all. I just showed you four of them. We are interested in beta 3. This is cancer and Taxol resistance or drug resistance class. Here, 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 we have differences. And we want to amplify these differences. This is where colchicine binds. The binding pocket for beta 2 and beta 3. And look what happened. There are three changes in the binding pocket of colchicine. Where threonine was, there's valine. Where cysteine was, there's serine. Where tyrosine was, there's arginine. The important differences or substitutions are that change polarity or charge. If something was neutral, is now negative or positive. This is important because you can form a new molecule that will bind more strongly. So there's fit, steric fit. You see some shape difference. You see the shape difference? There's a shape difference. Compare these two pockets. And then there is polar to no polar, non-polar change. This is not so important. This is a bit less. But here is a huge possibility, tyrosine to arginine, from polar to positively charged. Now we can make new drugs. This is the traditional culture scene in both binding pockets. Between beta 2 and beta 3, there is a void. But, so So, slight variation. We've designed 6 colchicine derivatives. I'm showing you. There's 12 more that we designed. I'm not showing you. And this one, I'll show you how it fits better in beta 3. It fits into this hollow opening with a 5-member ring that was added, and there's a void here in beta 2. So our prediction is this new drug would be selective in binding, would go into beta 3, which is overexpressed in cancers. It may allow you to lower the dose and use colchicine for the first time. So I have more, but in the interest of time, I will probably stop. I'll just try to summarize very quickly what else we are doing. They'll give you a better overview of what's happening. We've also done similar analyses for Paxil, and we are working on Vinca. Paxil is this extract from the Pacific yew tree, and interestingly, the tree develops Paxil to fight infections. So nature found solutions, but we try to improve these natural solutions. Just very quickly, I want to cut to the chase and give you an overview of what we are trying to do. This is the last slide with a picture, and then I'll give you some words. Okay. So, we have a protein, our target. Right? The protein is expressed differently in different cells, cancer cells specifically. In addition, there are mutations. Individual patients, in addition to changing, let's say, from beta 1 to beta 3, the cancer cells will mutate occasionally in some places. You know, there's a mutation. So this is called SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms. And we have a data bank at the Cross Cancer Institute that we're going through, and I'm sure here in Toronto you have the same thing. And we're looking for a correlation between drug resistance and the occurrence of these individual mutations. So we've identified several possibilities which would lead to drug resistance. So that will be done very shortly, within the next 2 months. And if we prove that, then, of course, this is a major step in advancing our research to design drugs, not for types of cancer, but patients, individual patients. You do a biopsy, you find this is expensive, so you have to be very careful what you analyze. But in principle, it's doable. And this is our general strategy. So we have a collaboration between Alberta, Texas, and New York. New York, of course, pays. They have the money. Texas has the expertise in synthesizing drugs, and we have the expertise in doing the computations. So our strategy is to model the binding sites, as I showed you, design specific drugs, simulate their action by computer models, calculating the binding energies, and then synthesize them in the chemical lab, and then test them in vitro on microtubules outside of the cell. And eventually, you do it on cells, you do cytotoxicity studies, and, well, hopefully, then you move on to animal models and then eventually to humans. The good thing about cancer research is that new drugs if they show promise, you can actually have smaller samples to get them approved. I don't remember what the cutoff is, but even a sample of like 20 patients may be enough to fast track a drug for approval. So this is all I have to say for the moment, and thank you very much for your attention.